This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. This is a show about ideas, people, and behaviors that are considered inappropriate, out of bounds, or beyond the pale. The things you're not supposed to talk about if you're a school teacher, a college professor, a businessman, a politician, a parent, a neighbor, or even a podcast host. These are the things you're not supposed to say or even think if you're a good liberal, a good conservative, or a good citizen. Each week, I'll interview a person who has something bad to say. They might be a journalist or a professor. They might be a porn star or a drug dealer. They might just be an ordinary person with an ordinary job who doesn't care about the rules of polite society. I'm not interested in breaking the rules just to be a troublemaker. I'm interested in people who break the rules of conventional thought and who expand the scope of what is possible to say in our society. I'm interested in people who make me think. My guest this week argues that not only has Ukraine lost the war, but the United States has lost the world. This is my interview with Glenn Deason. I am joined from Norway by Glenn Deason, who was on the show, I think about a year ago, to talk about your, I think, absolutely essential book on, and you've written, what is it, 10 now or 11? But this, the one that we talked about then was on Russophobia, which to me, and I said this to you at the time, I mean, I think that is the principal issue driving the war, is the Russophobia of especially Americans and sort of a passive, ignorant Russophobia. But, and you'd, I mean, it's the only place I've seen where there's just a, it's a, you just chronicle, take down, debunk, debunk, debunk. I have referenced that book almost every day since I talked to you about it. Every time I hear the word Skripal or Navalny, or I mean, all the poisonings, all the stuff, but and the history of Russophobia. So anyway, we're certainly going to talk about that now. But you have a new book because you're incredibly prolific, even though you have three children and are doing lots of podcasts and most notably on the Duran. But your new book is called The Ukraine War and the Eurasian World Order. And that title right there in itself should be shocking and terrifying to anybody who runs foreign policy in a Western country, if they believe it at all, right? Because what you're saying is you chart the sort of history of world orders. We can talk about the Westphalian order, and then what came in the modern era, and then sort of the American liberal hegemony order of our times. But you're saying in the book, and you say in the title, essentially, that the order we've lived under since 1945 is either ending or already has ended. In fact, what is your, it's a little unclear to me, which is the position you're taking? Is the liberal American hegemonic world order, is that over now, or is it just beginning its demise?
No, I argue it's already come to an end, but the new order hasn't really established itself. And this is part of the crisis we're in, because it's in a vacuum. We left the former order, but we haven't really cemented a new one. So in addition, the United States attempts to pull the world order back towards unipolarity. And most of the rest of the world would seek to move towards multipolarity. So when you said world order, I wouldn't say since 1945, because world order often tends to contrast hegemony versus other centers. So for example, when the Roman Empire, Holy Roman Empire collapsed at the Peace of Westphalia in 1648, we got a new system based on a balance of power between many centers of power. So that's not the hegemon. And since then, you know, this is a simple way of contrasting. And what happened after the Cold War was quite unique. The Cold War was two poles of power, which was also a bit unusual. Mm-hmm. But after the Cold War, there was one center of power. You know, Pax Americana had one dominant state. And this is a quite unique world order. That means, you know, poles are often used a bit abstract, but if one center of power means you have one military power dominating, you have one economic power dominating, one set of leading technologies, industrial capacity, one power controlling the transportation corridors, one having the dominant banks, the dominant currency, controlling the payment system, leading the main institutions, dominating the information space, and also having some ability to make up or interpret international law in its own interest, usually in the form of a sovereign inequality. So sovereignty for itself, but not others. So this was kind of the unipolar moment, the order. What we see now is the distribution has already shifted towards multipolarity, and this is part of the problem. We can either try to adjust to it or try to restore unipolarity, but this is the source of most of our conflict.
If we were living in a unipolar world still, as of February 2022, Russia could not have won the war. It couldn't possibly, right? I mean, and the reason they won the war principally is that they had their own resources and they had other countries to trade with and borrow from and all the rest of it, and big countries with big economies that could ship them large amounts of stuff and buy large amounts of stuff as well. In a truly unipolar world dominated by the United States, that never could have happened. And so are you saying, maybe I'm saying, that the course of the Ukraine war, which I think we all in this sphere believe has been essentially won by Russia, I mean, do you think that is evidence or proof of the end of the liberal world order?
Well, that's what the current, well, the order that lasted for about 30 years stood for. I refer to this liberal hegemony, because hegemony, because you have one center of power, but liberal is that's the justification for having hegemony. And also, it's authentic, well, genuine. There's many in the US who had this genuine belief that if there's only one center of power, you can prevent great power rivalry, because the international anarchy is kind of over. You have only the US as a policeman, and with that one center power, it can also elevate the role of liberal values, so democracy, human rights, which pacifies furthermore the international system. So this was the idea behind perpetual peace, but yeah, for a variety of reasons, this is not how it works. So as many predicted already in the early 90s, over time, in order to perpetuate liberal hegemon, after a while, the US would have to weaken all other rising powers, because if it allows them to rise, there wouldn't be a hegemon. And also, liberalism would be then, to an extent, well, to use a popular phrase, weaponized, because, for example, applying liberal ideals selectively according to power interests, which is why, for example, Iranian human rights abuses demand all the sanctions in the world, while Saudi, not that important. So it's, again, one can say hypocritical, but yeah, but this is the nature of states. They look for their power interest first. So.
So I've been literally since I was born, I have marched in the streets against every war by the United States. I have been an anti-imperialist my entire life. I have changed politics various times, but that has stayed constant. I have, in many ways, worked toward this moment, I suppose, my entire life. I'm not sure that moment's entirely here, but this is BRICS, the rising of BRICS, the course of the Ukraine war, the success of Russia against the United States and the West. This is a new place we're living in. What I want, a new world we're living in, what I want is to be able to tell people quickly and easily what the evidence is of that. I mean, I could say, well, there's BRICS and there's five countries and they have their own thing going on, but it's not a military alliance. We have several UN votes that show that the vast majority of the world's country governments disagree with the US Empire, the unipolar world they want the done with. So I have that. What I don't know, and I don't know if you can even answer this, but I don't know what ordinary people in Pakistan and Iran and even Russia and the rest of it think of it. I know what their governments think, and then that makes me worried that this is simply a power play and some new government will come up like China or Russia and will seek to dominate. We can get into that later, but I mean, how isolated are we in the West and especially the United States in this? I mean, with Israel and Gaza, it's become very clear. But I think even in Ukraine and NATO and Russia, I think even there, the rest of the world seems to be against us. But is that how true is that?
Well, on the first question, I guess, how would you quickly explain What evidence of multipolarity is? Well, you can go through the different categories. If you look at military power, obviously the inability to defeat key rivals, be it Russia, China, but also now this recognition that we can't let the Middle East get out of control, because this idea that one can defeat Iran, you know, if you run the military exercise or scenarios, it shows it can't really be done. They're getting too powerful. The relative power of the U.S. is not, it's still leading, but it's not as dominant as it was before. And also, it's in the tech sphere. When the U.S. was when the U.S. was dominant, it was comfortable with a liberal international economic system because it would naturally lead. But that's not the case anymore. Look at the tech area. There's a need to sabotage the Chinese, you know, cut off their access to chips, try to convince the Europeans not to buy 5G. We see the industrial power also weakening. We see transportation corridors. The Chinese coming with this Belt and Road Initiative. That's to ensure that the Americans can't dominate on these transportation networks. Banks. Much of the world don't want to be reliant on American banks only. And you know, and also international lenders like the IMF or World Bank, where the U.S. dominates, they don't want to use SWIFT anymore. The whole world is starting to look for their own alternatives, which is the payment system, which everything has to be cleared through the United States, in which it's an important instrument to impose unilateral sanctions. Also, they want to de-dollarize. Even you know, friends and allies of the United States, from India, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, they're all looking to diversify, not as an anti-American move, but just to diversify so it won't be so reliant.
Sure.
So that's just economic. And then you have the institutions, as you suggested. We have new institutions like BRICS, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, and a multitude of others. Also reflecting multipolarity. And of course, the information space. This really began more the mid-2000s with, you know, the Al Jazeeras and RTs.
Yeah.
And a good evidence that the U.S. isn't really adjusting to this, losing the dominance over information space, is obvious. If you go to PressTV.com, for example, it's the Iranian main Iranian English news channel, you'll come up a big... what is it called? Emblem from the United States, because the U.S. seized their entire website because they don't approve of their news agency. And of course, it's the same with Russia. All the Russian channels are banned. Look at Assange. You know, he's about to probably be sentenced for quite some time for, you know, spilling the secrets. And furthermore, only a few years ago, censorship in America was, you know, it's not for Americans. This is, you know, over there you have supposed to have stronger press freedom and the freedom of expression. But, you know, not anymore. Now censorship is across the West becoming more and more accepted, as long as you call something propaganda, which is usually the information of other states. And then you can look at other variables like international law. When there's unipolarity, kind of the rest of the world has to accept this notion that there's sovereignty for us, but not for others. So we come up with principles like democracy promotion, humanitarian interventions, effectively allowing, demoting the sovereignty of other states. But it's not that much approval for it anymore. And so when the US, for example, so back the coup in Ukraine, or have these forever wars, illegally occupying Syria and Iraq, you know, bombing Yemen, or supporting a genocide in Gaza. This is all now becoming, you know, the rest of the world isn't accepting this right and responsibility, if you will, of the United States to essentially, yeah, be the global policeman. As you suggested, politically as well, becoming more and more isolated. Not just the U.S., by the way, all the NATO countries are kind of isolating themselves.
Right.
So yeah, that's why it's not easy to a quick evidence. But there's obviously the 90s are over. I think this is quite evident. And I think if you want to see what most of the world, what they think, there's an interesting interview by Kishore Mahbubani. He's a Singaporean diplomat. He's also the former president of the United Nations Security Council.
Huh.
And, you know, he was interviewed about the war in Ukraine. And they said, you know, like most of the world outside of NATO, that is, they don't support the invasion of Ukraine, but they also don't want to join in on the sanction or condemnation of Russia. And the reason as well is they don't want to see Russia defeated, because it's not that they want to see Ukraine defeated, but they don't want to see NATO defeat Russia. And the reason is, this is largely a war about world order.
Yep.
If NATO can break Russia, they will also weaken China. And in his words, that world would be intolerable. The entire world doesn't want to live in under unipolarity anymore. And he said, imagine if the West would win this, and they would now have this be emboldened to continue to restore unipolarity. It would be a horrible world. They don't want to live in this. A lot of the world sees this as an issue of world order. The West sees it, Russia sees it, and yeah, most of the world. So I thought that's why it was a good way of framing it in this way.
Okay, well, I mean, that's an impressive array of evidence for the world changing outside the United States and outside of Western Europe. A lot has happened already. I mean, it's revolutionary in for many people around the world, but a change in attitude in particular around the world. Here's the problem, Glenn Deason. It's my neighbors over here, and it's my neighbors over there, my neighbors behind. It's all Americans have not gotten the news. They still are spectacularly ignorant about foreign affairs, about other countries, about they don't know anything about U.S. foreign policy. They know that Putin is a dictator and is a super bad guy, and that's the end of it. And they know that Hamas is super evil, and maybe other Islamists are super evil. And that's it. And we are going to have these wars, and there will be continued, seemingly, fights for unipolarity so long as my goddamn fellow Americans they seem impenetrable. They just will not change. I mean, there's a handful of us, of course, in America who watch the Duran and listen to you and read your stuff, but you know, that is less than 1% of the population. And of course, the political class here is even worse. I mean, almost unanimously supported the Ukraine war, almost unanimously supported Israel. And I know that you're not a specialist on US culture. To me, that is the reason people are dying in Ukraine and in Gaza and around the world, is simply because of American ignorance. And if half of it or more Americans read your books and listened to you, and I mean, I think the whole thing would change overnight. But we are so far from that that I'm afraid that his grim prediction about what will happen if the United States continues to dig in and continues to try to reestablish its dominance is going to happen. And I don't know. I just don't know how to get into the heads of Americans other than doing a podcast and having you on, you know? So I don't know have to say to that, but that's, to me, that's the heart of the issue, right? I mean,
I think people have to learn about the main issues because, well, you and I, we spoke before about political propaganda, and the reason why it really became a demand for it, especially over a century ago, is because, you know, the world was becoming very, very complex. And how is everyone, you know, in the United States, most people will become more concerned about domestic policies, but how would they know everything about foreign policy, for example, in all the continents of the world? It's a bit too much to demand from everyone. So, and this enables political leaders to essentially, you know, herd a group, not hurt, but herd. And the way they use it through heuristics, you know, it's, they can't learn about, well, not just Americans, the whole world. Not everyone can learn about everything. So you provide people with simple filters to interpret the world. So, you know, so you say, you know, all the world is divided between good guys and bad guys, or as we say, between liberal democracies and authoritarian states. So, you know, why are we bombing Yemen? It's like, well, you have radical Muslims and freedom lovers. Okay. And then you can filter through this, and you know, this is all you need. And you ask, you know, you said Putin is a you know, dictator, but this is also why every time we go after a new enemy, you know, it can be Yugoslavia, Iraq, Syria, you know, China, Russia, Iran, it doesn't really matter. Every time they refer to us a new Hitler. So Hitler is reincarnated pretty much in every war. And it's and you know, we're always living in the 1930s, and it's a powerful way to look at the world, because what you're saying is the world is divided. We're good guys, they're bad guys. There can only be peace in the world if we defeat the bad guys. If you try to make peace with them, well, we learn from Hitler, that's appeasement. So there can be no negotiations, they have to be defeated. So you kind of have this you know, playbook which you just can do over and over again. And yeah, it's it becomes quite dangerous after a while, because there's no rational debate. All the complexities of the world can't be, you know, dumbed down to this. As I often make the point, this idea that, if we just, we have conflict now because the other country has a really bad guy as a leader. If we can just kill him or get rid of him, we'll go back to everything being normal and nice again. This is how you would explain politics to a child. It's not serious, but this is, again, I'm not going to pick on the US alone because we do the same here in Europe. So it's not a good way.
But
take away from rationality. That's my point.
No, for sure. I mean, but again, I'm going to stay on this because I'm pretty convinced that US really culture is at the heart of this. It's really I think it's the origin of all those dead bodies in the fields in Avdiivka right now. I do. Because you have this profoundly ignorant population that does almost nothing about the world outside its borders. But then you have a political class in this country since the founding, they've all spoken this way, that believes that we are obligated by God to go out and save the world. Not just be the world's policeman, but be the world's social worker, be the world's protector, be the political class. And the people who've actually made the decisions in the United States around foreign policy, the major decisions, have been like a couple hundred people. I mean, it's been a tiny little class now called the blob. They call themselves that. The foreign policy establishment is what I'm talking about. They and every president and every senator since the beginning has had this idea. Basically, it's sort of an evangelical universalism that is just only America. This is, I mean, you see a little bit of this in Rome, a little bit of this universalism talk in Rome, but not really. A little bit with the Brits, but not like us. We just went whole hog on this Christian idea about going out and converting all nations. And we just, the political class won't let it go. Now, I watch Kamala Harris talk, say the words, and it's obvious she doesn't even care or know what she's talking about. So I don't know if that idea, which has guided American politics and it has shaped the entire world, that idea of American exceptionalism, I hope that that will fade, but I haven't seen any evidence of it, except maybe the insincere mouthings of the vice president. But I mean, generally speaking, the whole political class in this country, if you ask them about Russia, they will just say Putin's a dictator. I mean, and they'll go to war. So again, well, this is not your specialty, but like, I just think that's the problem.
There was an argument, I remember in the early 2000s, that the democracy doesn't work if people are uninformed, if they're too stupid. And the people pointed to a poll, because on the eve, I think, of the US invasion of Iraq, there was, I'm not sure if it was a majority, or it was, I think it was a majority who believed that Saddam Hussein had something to do with 9/11. And and it was interesting, because if you remember back in those days, Bush had a tendency, whenever he talked about 9/11, he connected the sentence to Iraq. He never made the accusation, I think, explicitly, because there was no evidence, and also it would have been stupid to suggest Iraq or Saddam Hussein even had contact with Al-Qaeda. I mean, they hated each other quite fiercely. But as long as you put those two next to each other the whole time, after a while, you know, the way the human mind works, it's human beings, we conflate the familiar with the known. So if we hear something over and over again, then we it sounds true to us. That's just how we work. And but one has to ask himself the question as well, with Ukraine, for example. When Russia invaded Ukraine 2 years ago, the vast majority, couldn't pick it on the map. They didn't know the history. But yet everyone was 100% certain in the morality of this. This was, Russians trying to crush their freedoms. You had the bad Russian and they had the poor freedom-seeking Ukraine. And then you had, America, NATO on, a knight in shining armor who came to save, the innocent from the wicked. And, so the story was made and everyone suddenly was 100% sure exactly what the story was about, even though they knew nothing about the country or any of the history. If you're this certain and you know nothing, perhaps someone is, manipulating you. And but I think you're right as well with you mentioned two words, this responsibility, and then you talked about the universal mission.
Yeah.
And this is why I think it's that's why I also wanted to look at world order, because I think We'd already done a lot of this in the 19th century. At this point, the British had the same. They were developing liberal empire. And they said, well, liberalism is a universal value. So once something is universal, that means no more do accommodate for cultural and civilizational differences. That means we can impose it on others, because if all the world have to follow the same development model and we're the champions of it, it's not just our right to lead the rest of the world, it's our responsibility.
Yep.
So, you know, we're like the teacher and we look at the bad students. Yes, we punish them sometimes, but it's because we want the best for them. And this is kind of the mentality that that ran the British, you know, they call it liberal empire. America calls liberal hegemony, but it's surprisingly similar, the ideas. When you have hegemony matched with universal values, even though it's best intentions, it ends up where we are now.
It's deeply paternalistic, and it's a view of the world that I find just absolutely bizarre, because it is so arrogant. And Americans who know next to nothing about the world will proceed to vote for a war in some part of the world because of this. But I want to stay here on this question of, on this issue about universalism, because I think I was listening to you when this sort of occurred to me, that might be the fundamental difference between the current leaders of the multipolar world, whatever you want to call it, the BRICS countries, and America. They don't seem to be, and I'm talking about the Russians and the Chinese in particular, the governments there. I have not seen any evidence of any of that kind of thinking. They don't seem to feel like they have any responsibilities for me or anywhere else in the rest of the world. And they also don't seem to feel like they have the right to intervene to help other people, to save other countries, et cetera. Is that right? And if that's true, gosh, I mean, that's a much better world, I think, in which no state thinks that it's my dad.
Yeah,
that's what the United States is, right? They think they're your dad. I mean,
Well, that's why I think the rhetoric often suggests, listen, we have to support, you know, the U.S. global dominance. Otherwise, it's going to be China. But I think this is a false or a wrong argument to make, because the U.S. hegemony won't be replaced by a Chinese hegemony. First of all, it's when there's multipolarity, other countries wouldn't want it. If even Russia, which is the best or most important ally of Russia, of China, they wouldn't want to stay with the Chinese if they went for hegemony, because that would demand that they seek that Russia cut its ties with other central or key poles of power. Now, so what makes me optimistic about China is not only that they seem to accommodate economic diversification. That is, when they trade with Russia, they're more economically powerful than Russia, obviously, but they don't mind. They know that the Russians don't want to be too dependent on only one actor, because if you have too much dependent on an asymmetrical relationship, then of course Russia would begin to become excessively reliant and have to cede some political influence to the Chinese. So the Russians want to diversify, also go with India, you know, Iran, Japan, Korea, just to make sure that they don't put all their eggs in one basket. Now, and then the Chinese are okay with this. They're saying, well, listen, we don't want hegemon, we're in for multipolarity. And of course, they can say this while they build up economic strength. But at the same time, they're also denouncing universal values. Now, if you're an aspiring hegemon, you want to come up with universalism. You will talk about liberal democracy or Marxism, something.
Yeah.
This is a universal value.
Yeah.
And everyone's on the same path of development. We're more advanced than you. So now we assert leadership over you. They're not doing this. And even the key program they have to, which they try to shape relations with other states, they call it the global, global civilizational initiative or something along those lines. Anyways, the main idea is that all the major civilizations, they're rather different. They have different geography, different history. And so it's natural to have different paths to development. So the main idea is we reject the universal claim that one civilization should tell another one how to develop. Each civilization will go its own way to find out how to develop. It's not for us to dictate what other ones. So for me, this is very reassuring, because if you have a growing power who doesn't claim to represent universal values, then they seem to follow both an idea or ideology about multipolarity while embracing multipolarity. So again, I'm sure there's counter arguments, but you know, these are the discussions we should be having, not whether or not, you know, we have to fight China. I think this is a bit too premature to this should be the last option, not the first.
Yeah, I mean, what I see there is actually a cultural relativism, right? In the so far in the governments of China and Russia, they don't make claims about other cultures being inferior or superior or in need of development or saving. And I'm wondering, it's and also this thing about treating each civilization sort of with respect, essentially, each national culture with respect. That's I don't know where this comes from in the East. I like it. It sounds like Dugin. It sounds like Alexander Dugin's theories. And I don't know. Do you know where this came from? Because in the United States, it's just an alien idea, right? We know that these other cultures are bad, and we know that we need to go raise them up. Is this like is this sort of an intellectual movement that's sort of emerged in these countries, or is it just the current leaders think this way?
I don't know. You can probably argue it has some roots from, you know, Chinese Confucianism and all, but I'm I have to think about this for a while.
Yeah, because
I'm not sure. It's a good question where it comes from.
Yep.
Because often realists get cynical. They suggest that the international distribution of power, which decides which ideas should be elevated. In other words, if all power would be concentrated in China, much like it was in the United States in the 90s, realist scholars would assume that then China would start to develop values and ideologies that embrace universal ideals. So they would effectively be able to create an international system based on sovereign inequality, where, you know, they have full sovereignty, no one interferes with us, but we can interfere everywhere because we're the, you know, we're the leader. Now, but of course, there are cultural differences and to countries. So I don't know. That's why I also refer to it as a Eurasian Westphalian state, because if you see the UK and the United States, when they each of them respectively dominated the world, they did so as maritime powers. That means they controlled from the sea effectively. And in order to dominate, they meant in Europe, the British and then Americans always realized, okay, we have to keep the Germans and the Russians apart, because if they come together, they will be too powerful. It will form a center of power which can threaten us. So just keep the main power divided. This is, again, it's not a big secret. This comes up in through history and all the documents. But for a huge Eurasian power like China, if they want to grow and be dominant, they're not primarily a maritime power. They're a Eurasian land power. They're gonna have to learn how to harmonize with other states. So my point, for example, if you compare Russia and China, they have different formats for Eurasian integration. How to integrate this whole continent from, you know, the Pacific to the Atlantic, but they're different formats, but they can't do it without the other. If the Chinese would start to undermine the Russians can create a horrible, horrible time for the Chinese. So they have to find a way of accommodating each other. And this was also the idea of Russian Eurasianists in the 1920s, the ones who fled when the Soviets the Bolsheviks took power. They effectively had this vision, we can be a natural anti-imperialist because, in Eurasia, we can't lead unless we harmonize our interests with other peoples. So.
Oh, there it is. Yeah. I mean,
that's what I'm saying. It could be something.
Yeah. Because that sounds, I think that's Dugin. I mean, I think he comes out of that Eurasianist tradition.
Very much so.
Yeah. That's the heart of it. That's the heart of it. That's explains everything. And it's the solution to everything too. Once Americans just need to get over their evangelical impulses.
Yeah, but you mentioned that paternalism before as well.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the reasons why most of the world doesn't want unipolarity anymore. Because if you have many centers of power, what is the role, for example, of diplomacy? It's for countries to harmonize. You know, we have competing interests. We have to put ourselves in each other's shoes, and then we have to try to reach a compromise so we can harmonize interests. This is what the diplomats should do. But not in the unipolar order, because in this system, there is no compromise necessarily. Then the dominant state, which believes it's advancing universal ideals, is not making compromises. You don't compromise with someone inferior. That, you know, this is not the way to go. Then you socialize other states. So the leading state is the teacher. The rest are students. Yeah. And your objective is to socialize them. And you don't put yourself in their shoes. You don't make, you don't meet them halfway. So diplomacy to a large extent becomes about how you can create incentives for them to change their internal governance. If they, or for example, NATO experience with the Russians, if they do well, if they do as they're told, then they can attend our meetings. So we have this Russia-NATO Council, and the Russians could never negotiate anything on the agenda. But and as soon as there was any conflicts, we wouldn't use those institutions to resolve them, like we had in conflict with in over Georgia in 2008. Instead, at those times, we just suspend cooperation in those institutions because we want to punish them. That's another thing. If the student behaves badly, they have to be punished. If they behave well, they're rewarded. And we use the institutions to punish or reward, but we don't use them to what diplomacy is supposed to be all about. So I think a lot of the world has grown very tired of this, which is why you see, even American allies in the Arab world, India and all, it's very hard to convince them that they should sign up for this unipolar order. It's pretty much just the Europeans who signed up.
Yeah. Okay. I want to kind of finish talking about liberalism. And I want to talk about the content of liberalism and whether there's a crisis in liberalism in what's going on. And then I want to talk about Navalny and specifically Russian liberalism, because you have an argument about that I think is totally essential, and I want people to hear it. We've been calling it has been called the liberal world order, liberal hegemony. I don't know what's your favorite term, but it's at least professed liberal values and has preached liberal values and has promised to deliver liberalism to other countries. Right now, what is the content of that? What has it been? I mean, it's been called democracy. It's been called, the rights that we have in the Bill of Rights. But I mean, obviously, it's been a sham for the most part. We know this. I mean, no democracy was brought to Iraq or anywhere else, really, and lots of killing instead. But I do believe that American leaders have basically believed that. Nonetheless, I think they've been true believers. That's been the problem. In fact, they've been willing to kill hundreds of millions of people for it. But is the multipolar world, the multipolar movement, is it rejecting liberalism, or is it just rejecting Uncle Sam being the boss? Right. I mean, are the values of liberalism at stake here being contested or not?
Well, it's a lot of things to unpack there. I think, what's the first aspect? It was,
what's the content of the liberalism that's being spread around the world? Yeah.
Well, first you mentioned the many who genuinely believe it. And I think this was one of the problems in the 1990s. You had some people wanted just, this is our chance to have world dominance. You know, we had the Cold War, we won, now we're going to have dominance. And then you had those who wanted a different world where humanitarian values should be elevated. So you had these, the liberal ideas, as well as their very much more harder realist thinking. And it was kind of like a marriage of a convenience between the liberals and the imperialists, if you will. And, they kind of had the same goals, if you think the hegemony will deliver liberalism. I think that the world has rejected for two main reasons. One is that liberalism applied within the United States and within the West hasn't really been working the way it was supposed to, because you can look at political liberalism or economic liberalism. In political liberalism, the individual comes first, is based on reason, and we again it's also based to a large extent on the slogans of the French Revolution, liberty, equality, and fraternity. However, liberalism has to be always balanced. Human beings are a social animal. So in the French Revolution, they had this three phrases, fraternity or brotherhood. That was the last one. We tend to leave that one out because you can't just have radical individualism because that dissolves effectively the group. It can create, unravel a lot of the societal structure. But I guess, but in terms of economic liberalism, this has also been a difficult aspect. I mean, these days we kind of reinvented the ideas of Adam Smith, suggesting, that the government had to get out of the way. But this was more of a neoliberal ideas which really emerged in the 1970s, because traditionally economic liberalism, it needs some intervention at some point, because over time there will be a concentration of wealth. Even the foremost spokespeople of economic liberalism, if you have David Ricardo and others, they also recognized over time there will be more and more concentration of wealth, and you're not going to be able to have democracy. So at some point you have to have some distribution of wealth as well. But it kind of goes without saying, if the US has these powerful oligarchs, people are now saying, oh, Zuckerberg is trying to undermine democracy, but our other oligarchs like Elon Musk, he's saving it. If this is what democracy depends on, which oligarchs are in control, it's not going to be a very stable or good future. So I think the excesses of liberalism, I think, has been turned off by much of the world. But in terms of embracing individualism and reason, I think much of the world has become very liberal. So okay. I wouldn't dismiss what the French Revolution, American Revolution contributed to in terms of delivering on political realism. Right. But in terms of ruling the world, I think you used the both phrase, liberal hegemon. Yes, that's a hegemon advancing liberalism, but the liberal or the rules-based international order, this is something that much of the world despises. And we don't always understand it in the West because, when we say rules-based international order, we use it as a synonym for international law. But these are two very different things. After World War II, this is when we got the UN Charter, which represents international law. It's based on the idea of sovereign equality, mutual constraint. After the Cold War, that's when we began to advance these ideas of rules-based international order, which effectively means you're adding humanitarian values on top of it, but then you create contradictory possible policies. For example, let's say, a common example is Kosovo. What happened there? We said, Kosovo has to be able to embrace self-determination. So they have to break apart from Serbia. So self-determination comes at the expense of territorial integrity. Well, how about Crimea? No, that's, we can't have self-determination there. There we need to keep territorial integrity of Ukraine. So, and we see this over and over again. The principle chosen are always rooted in power politics, but we created a dual system. Sometimes we ignore sovereignty. Sometimes it's the most important thing. And who gets to decide? Well, the US and its allies. And this is why the rest of the world says, well, what are these rules in the rules-based international order? And they effectively, began to reject it because there is no rule book.
Yeah. So I'm guessing that in Russia, for many, maybe most Russians, and certainly the government in Russia, they view liberalism as a subversive movement led by the West. I mean, seems to me they see it primarily, and this is, I think, quite rational. They see it primarily simply as just an attack on their sovereignty. You know, that's what the West says is liberalism is really just the CIA trying to take us down. And this is, this came up with the death of Navalny, I don't understand how people can view the way, I don't understand how damn near everybody in the West sees it the way that they do, because if some American guy was working with the Russian government inside the United States, trying to win elective office, try to become mayor of New York City and then president of the United States, and was getting money and support and funds and agents and to help him. I mean, we might not kill him, but he sure as hell would be in prison forever. So it's just baffling to me. But you made a really important argument about the nature of the movement Navalny led in Russia, sort of the I don't know, liberal opposition, which kind of had a brief moment there and essentially has died. But, you know, 10, 15 years ago, Navalny was getting some numbers. There was like a significant, maybe 10 to 20% of Moscow population was kind of pro-liberal, pro-West. But what is the nature of liberalism in Russia? And should the state be concerned about it? Or should it, you know, because we're saying here, oh, he's just a liberal. He's just talking about freedom of speech. We would never harm him. That is no threat to America. We tolerate ideas. Navalny wasn't just speaking about ideas, right? And the liberal movement in Russia was not just about freedom, was it?
No. Well, the liberalism and Navalny, there's overlapping, but of course not the completely same. But Russia's always, it's always when it's moved towards liberalism, it's always had to take a step back when it ends up in a war or conflict with the West. Now, even, you know, Catherine the Great, you know, she was very much pro, eager in terms of implementing French liberalism until the French Revolution, when she saw, when, you know, began becoming revolutionary, cutting people head off, these kind of things. That's when she turned a bit cold on it. But overall, I think it was the way it was introduced in Russia, because after the defeated Napoleon, it was those soldiers who had been exposed to it, if you will, They took Paris, who came back, who attempted to stage a coup in the Decembrist Revolution in 1825. Oh, so it was introduced in Russia almost in terms of regime change, not gradual reforms, but regime change. And this kind of became the legacy, because if you saw ever since, the liberals were kind of often seen as somewhat traitors, and for a good reason, actually, because they often favored, willing to sell out their own country. And this has been one of the challenges of Russia. They need liberal patriots. And interestingly, over the past 10 years, this is something that's emerged, and this is rather new. But I don't want to throw that term around without substantiating it, because this has always been the issue. Some Russians said, you know, oh, Napoleon should invade it. We would have been a better country. This is kind of been a theme for some. So it's very, you know, it's a bit wrong. But also when they had the war with Japan in 1905, this was also when some liberals would write to the emperor in Japan and wish him good luck invading Russia. You know, so they did this kind of stuff. There was very, very treasonous, but also they led to bad things, because keep in mind that before the Bolshevik Revolution, you had the Democratic Revolution, in which in 1905 as well, when they kind of swept away a lot of the old system without having something solid in place. And this opened the door for the Bolshevik revolutions shortly thereafter. And so you often see liberals behaving quite weird. So just one example, the foreign minister of Boris Yeltsin, Andrei Kosirev. Do you know where he lives now? The foreign minister of Russia. Oh, he moved to America. He took American citizenship. Now he lives in Miami. If you go to his Twitter profile, this is the foreign minister of Russia. He spends most of his time tweeting about how America should send more weapons and missiles to kill Russians. This was the foreign minister, very liberal. And this is kind of the problem. Imagine an American foreign minister moving to Russia or China, calling for killing Americans. It would be obscene. But this is kind of the direction they go. And so this has been a key issue. And of course, whenever there's someone they can sell as a liberal to destabilize Russia, the West often jumps on it, because, you know, we don't want, of course, we would like Russia to democratize more, but we also want to destabilize it and weaken it. So we have a conflicting interest. And this is the deal with Navalny as well. He was reinvented as a very liberal person, but this is also the guy who called all the Muslims in Russia cockroaches, and, you know, extremely ethno-nationalist. And again, this is not the, you know, one doesn't want to speak ill of the dead. It's often a tragedy. And I also make the point that Russians should ask very critical questions if a political leader, if you will, dies in prison. But that being said, his popularity in Russia came often from investigation of corruption, and he was a blogger. This made him very popular. Well, with that popularity, he got political aspiration, political aspirations. And if you read the papers, such as the Rand paper for what's it called? Iran paper. It's pretty much intelligence agencies, think tanks in America, and they
Oh,
wrote a
Rand.
report for the U.S. Army. Yeah, Rand. They wrote a report exhausting Russia or no,
Oh,
extending Russia. Sorry,
extending
that's the
Russia.
one.
Extending
Yeah,
Russia.
and they even mentioned Navalny by name many times. The report is mainly about how to destabilize Russian borders, but it's also how to destabilize internally. And they write about having to finding someone who can be popular, ideally fighting corruption, someone like Navalny. But we can't work directly with him, someone like Navalny. And his name keeps popping up because that will discredit him. So it's just
I
it was
mean,
very much in the face. So when he took political aspirations and kind of the West began to reinvent him as this wonderful Democrat, he lost a lot of the popularity, which is why I find it obscene. I'm watching, Michael McFaul, for example, the former American ambassador to Moscow, saying that he was the main opposition leader. Like, no, he was not. This is just is factually wrong. He had like 1 or 2% approval. The main opposition party is the Communist Party. I'm not a Marxist. I don't want the communists to come to party, but I should to power. But I still have to relate to objective reality. They are the main opposition. Then you have many other political parties. Navalny is not on this list. And just one last funny thing, because I saw it in the media today. Because now, as soon as he died in prison, all Western leaders say, Putin killed him, Putin killed him. A lot of these sanctions today in the Ukrainian media, Budanov, which is the head of Ukrainian intelligence services, he wrote, well, he said in an interview that, no, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but from what we understand, he died of a blood, what do you call it, blood clots.
Blood clot,
So, yeah, so he did not, he was not killed by Putin. And this is the Ukrainian head of the intelligence. So this is, I'm not saying he's correct, like I'm not sure why he's saying it, but anyways, it just shows people shouldn't get carried away too fast. Ask for evidence if. If we're still looking for who killed Epstein, but we knew the second Navalny died who did it, perhaps, it's a narrative and not reality. That's my point.
I mean, I'm not even talking about who killed him. I'm just talking about his general persecution by the Russian government. So, the typical American, and this gets to the heart of the problem, it kind of circles back, which is good. Americans look at this and they hear, oh, Navalny was he was a traitor against a but against an authoritarian, corrupt government, and he wanted to bring some Western liberal values and freedoms to Russia, and he was persecuted, prosecuted, and possibly killed by the government for that. I mean, they're going to say, oh, well, we should support that guy and we should support people like him and we should maybe send even guns to them if they want. Right? So what's because there's nothing but virtue in that story on his part. So why would a realist like you or me or whoever take a different position? And what is the position? What would you say to an American like that?
Well, I think if you want to develop to allow Russia to improve its democracy, because they have a lot of flaws in their democracy, let the Russians do it. I mean, this because every time there's someone on the liberal side coming up, immediately we throw our weight behind it, but we have our very sneaky motivations. I mean, this is what happened with Juan Guaido in Venezuela. We name our own favorite opposition and then use it to weaken Venezuela. Also in Belarus, I always forget her last name, Svetlana Tsikhovskaya, something along those lines. Anyways, she's the Navalny, if you will, of Belarus. But she's paraded around Western capitals like the real leader of Belarus, and meanwhile, she's standing there going to all these military conferences, calling for sanctions on her own country, and it's just this is not the they should let these countries develop on their own. And if you look at Russia's history, experience with liberalism, it's especially through the 19th century, and well, you see that they're making progress And then they end up with tensions and conflict with the West, and then they have to scale it all back. So just the one has to. The Russians came with this prince concept of sovereign democracy, which is you can't be a democracy unless you're sovereign. So all this American state-financed NGOs who are pushed in, we call them NGOs, but that stands for non-governmental, but they're all 100% funded by the U.S. government. When they come in to organize a civil society of other countries, it's not it's, it can't be democracy if you have other countries trying to elect your leaders. This is something India is also pushing back against. They don't want all of this, so they see it as a corruption of their democracy. And I think it goes a little bit back to what you said, is paternal idea that the only way other countries can develop democracy is if we do it for them. I think it's undermining democratic development, and it's a great shame.
Yeah, it's one thing to give your vocal support to someone like Navalny in another country, but to have your government assist him materially in leading, I think you've called it a revolutionary movement. Liberalism in Russia certainly takes that
Yeah, well, I think
form,
that's
right?
what the Russian government was more worried about, because he's not able to get any votes, but the ability to, organize riots, create a Maidan like the
Yeah.
regime change operation in Ukraine. I think this is the problem. And also, when you call him this great Democrat, we don't show the videos on, because he's been caught, his right hand, I forgot his name, Arkady something. He was caught on a tape in
Yeah,
Moscow where
right.
he's effectively talking to the to a British official. Russia said it was FSB, but anyways, where then the right hand of Navalny is trying to ask for money. Hey, give us like
Yeah.
20 million and give us some intelligence you have that can be used against the government. This is good investment. We can weaken this government, destabilize the country for you.
Yeah.
These are Imagine, remember in the United States when there was false allegation that Trump had colluded with Russia, how everyone lost their mind.
Oh, yeah.
That was a fake story. All of these
Yeah.
stories are real. This is
Right.
the United States corrupting and interfering in its democratic process. This is one have to appreciate, put yourself in the shoes of the other side. How would the United States react? This is,
I mean,
but again, you're not allowed to criticize. Come with objective facts, because then say, "Oh, he's degrading Navalny's." No, I don't stepping on anyone's grave or anything. I'm just saying this is you have to be able to state what's objectively true.
Right. And it's
So he
what
was
got him,
not up to.
and it's what got him imprisoned and maybe killed was his relationship with the United States and the British. I mean, so if we had stayed out of it, he probably would have lived, actually. If he had just led a liberal movement in Russia, I know a lot of Putin haters will not believe this, but I think it's true. If he had gained a mass following, there might have been some crackdowns for sure. But at this point, with 5% or less, I'm sure they would let him go if he's truly just a Russian
Yeah.
individual, right? So,
Well, because I think he had an important societal function. If he was exposing
sure.
corruption among the government, wonderful.
Sure.
Corruption is not good for Russia. It's not
Of
good
course.
for the country.
Yeah.
It's good that it's emerging. But if you see someone popping up in Russia, becoming popular because exposing democracy, and your first thought is, wow, I can use this guy to weaken the government and challenge its legitimacy. Well, you're weaponizing the opposition. You're not allowing political pluralism to manifest itself in a peaceful way. And this is my main concern. And again, usually I'm opposed by people who call themselves, Democrats, the ones who wants to advance democracy, yet they're the ones stepping all over it. We have this same in this country, in Norway. We have whenever we have protesters in Russia begin throwing stuff at cops or something, it's like, yay, I support those guys. But we would never approve of that in our country. So why are we advocating violence against police officers? It's just,
Right.
and then of course Russia sees the news. They see our political leaders cheering on the people committing violence and illegal acts. So it's just, no, it's we're not helping anyone. That's my point.
Okay, last question. And neither one of us is in the business of making predictions, and maybe we shouldn't. But I do think those of us who study this stuff, I do think we should be offering some some looks ahead for what we might expect. I mean, I unfortunately am quite pessimistic. I mean, I see the multipolar world eventually winning. I do see the United States ending its position as the hegemon. I don't know when, how long that'll take. But what I'm growing increasingly sure of, and this is, it's even hard to say because it's so terrifying. I mean, they're not giving up. The political class is not giving up its mission. And in this country, and as I said, the Americans are so ignorant, no one's going to stop them. They're not going down out without a fight. That seems very clear to me. And I just see lots more war as this new order emerges to replace the old one. What do you think?
Well, that's the point we're at. This is why this point in history is so very dangerous, because the U.S. has effectively two options. It can either help to facilitate a multipolar world and take a, you know, try to take a key role in this, to be the first among equals, if you will, or it can try to oppose this, but that would put them in direct conflict, not just with Russia, but now Iran and possibly China as well. And this is seemingly the direction they're going, because, you know, planning wars against everyone now. And again, I think this is why, because so much at stake, you know, choosing the entire world order. We're going to live all under, restore unipolarity under U.S. leadership or go to multipolarity. Given there's so much at stake, this is why they're willing to risk so much. You know, could be at the brink of nuclear war, and we still don't seem to be taking very crazy risks. For example, you know, a year ago or so, Biden, he made this point that, oh, we can't send F-16s because that would trigger World War III. And now, a week or ago, you had the NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg not only sending F-16s, but he said, we've greenlighted that these can be used to attack deep inside Russia. So now we might have American F-16s, you know, bombing Russian cities. We already had American cluster ammunition, illegal ammunition, being used against civilian targets against Russian cities. And, you know, when people, they brush this off and they say, well, you know, it's just, we're just supplying weapons to them to defend themselves. But what if the Russians or Chinese gave weapons to Venezuela to strike deep inside Russian and American territory? And furthermore, there was an article yesterday in the New York Times. I'm not sure if you saw it. This is a... It's about how the CIA helped Ukraine, and they point out on the eve of the coup in Ukraine, that is on the 24th of February 2014. That's when interesting date. It's the same date Russia invaded 8 years later. But anyways, this was after the American and many of the European countries had supported the coup. On the same day, the new government, which, you know, through leaked phone calls, we know was largely installed by the United States. They picked who should be in the government and who shouldn't. Anyways, on the same day Yanukovych had to flee the country, the new government has a, the post-coup government has a new security chief, intelligence chief, and he comes into the building on the first day of the coup. And the New York Times, right? The first thing he did was then to call the CIA and MI6 and suggest a trilateral agreement in which they all work together. And after this, the United States began to develop CIA began to develop the secret bases all along the Russian border, where they began to intercept all the communication. They went in and captured drones to reverse engineer it, and effectively beginning the war right after the coup. But still, how did it go this far? I mean, this is my point. I think all rules have been thrown out the window because there's so much at stake. And now we are, you know, the United States is providing the intelligence, the weapons, the targeting, everything. It's pretty much a war now fought between the U.S. and Russia, but, you know, fighting with Ukrainians. It's, you know, a lot can go wrong anytime. So, and this is just the U.S., we're doing going the same direction on the Middle East. Iran will be a horrible mess. And China, I mean, the idea of going to war with China, the fact that we've been talking about this is a huge mistake. The Chinese are not preparing because we're talking very openly about going to war against them. We see what NATO has done with Russia, and they know that they would be next on the chopping block if Russia falls. So it's it's a terrible mess we got ourselves into, and I'm not sure how to get out of this. No good recommendations, I'm afraid, except perhaps people, you know, come to some common sense and stop treating diplomacy and negotiations as naughty words. If it was up to me, I would have some diplomats fly to Moscow and say, you know, let's talk about neutrality for Ukraine. You know, it's not about giving Ukraine over to Russia. It's, you know, people say Ukraine should have freedom to what it wants to do. But I say, you know, Ukraine needs to have the same freedoms as Mexico. Mexico can partners with whomever it wants, but Mexico does not have the freedom to join a Chinese or Russian military alliance and put its bases on America's borders. It doesn't have that freedom. Right. And, you know, it's quite reasonable to give these basic security guarantees to the Russians. If that could be done, I think the Russians would... you know, be able to compromise on much other things, but neutrality is the one thing we'll never negotiate on, because they can't, you know, live the way they lived the last 10 years.
Yep. So much is at stake. I mean, I'm really fearing that we're entering a new era that might look like the middle of the 20th century. But maybe not, because you're writing books and you're on podcasts and you're speaking, and there's other people doing it too. And I noticed, I mean, I think your audience is growing. I've noticed more and more people, I think, are watching your videos, and I don't know about your books, but, you know, there is a change to some degree in the way people are thinking among some people, and we might become a significant enough minority to actually change some minds and maybe bring a little world peace. So, Glenn Deason, thank you very, very much for all the work you do, and thank you for coming on this show.
Thank you so much. And yeah, just like I say, I agree with your sentiment. I think people should start to question the people. Perhaps the people who say, you know, weapons are the only path to peace, negotiations and diplomacy is dangerous, and, you know, censor everyone who disagrees with us. Maybe these are not the good guys with the moral high ground.
Right.
That would be my advice. So, Anyways, thank you so much again. I appreciate having me.
Thank you.
This is the Unregistered Podcast, and I'm Thaddeus Russell. To become a patron of the show, and have access to bonus episodes, AMAs, and the unreported news analysis show, go to patreon.com/unregistered. Thanks for listening.